We'll hear from Mr. Dunn. Just a moment for changeovers in tennis matches. So.
They don't know what they're missing. May it please the Court, Matthew Dunn for Appellant Michael Rees. Unlike the other persons convicted in this bribery investigation, there's no hard evidence that Mr. Rees actually accepted any particular bribe. Instead, he was convicted on the basis of testimony from questionable sources, a few rather ambiguous recordings, and a gift list. And that's why we think the evidentiary rulings in this case are so important, and also why we think the Court should take a close look at sentencing in this case. So I'd like to start with the first evidentiary ruling about the gift list and the testimony attendant to the gift list. Again, as we say in our brief, this was error for at least two reasons. One, it's not a business record. And two, it was not admissible under Rule 404B. I'd like to start with the business record issue. As we outlined in our brief, this was a handwritten note, a list of names, found on a discarded notepad in an empty office by a plumbing foreman who happened to work at this company. This does not bear any of the hallmarks or indicia of reliability that we look to in a business record. I think it's helpful here to just remember briefly why we allow business records, even though they're hearsay. The Rules Committee explain that business records are supplied by systematic checking, by regularity and continuity, which produce habits of precision. The actual experience and business of relying on them, or the duty to make an accurate record as part of the continuing job or occupation. Now here, there are two serious problems. One is, it's not clear at all, even if we speculate that this list would meet those indicia. And secondly, certainly the record is lacking in support to make those assumptions. I think it's helpful here to contrast this with, for example, the drug ledgers, which are found admissible as business records in a lot of cases. And of course, we don't contest that records of illegal activity can, in some cases, be business records. However, the cases the government cites, drug ledgers are ledgers, just like a business record. And there's considerable testimony that the person recording it had personal knowledge, that it was a business reason, that it had to be accurate, and that it was made for the purpose of being relied on afterward. That's exactly what a business record is, of course. So when we look at books of account or phone record or something, it's a record of something that actually happened that a business makes for business reasons of looking back at it afterwards and seeing what the facts were. Excuse me just a second. By contrast, this list is anything sort of a to-do list or a list of intentions, what somebody plans to do rather than an accurate record of what is done. There's certainly no evidence that it was relied on afterward or that it needed to be accurate. And here we can look at the testimony of Ms. Roma Santa, who worked for Mr. Garniotti, the putative author of this list. Ms. Roma Santa said she believed she'd seen a similar list once or twice. On cross-examination, she was quite equivocal and said she may have never seen a business list. She certainly said she didn't see this business list, the 2005 business list, or she couldn't say that she had. She had no knowledge.
She did testify. She recognized the handwriting as Garniata's, and that she,
that's correct.
And that she recognized names on the list, and she testified to the practices and procedures of keeping these lists.
Well, I agree with the first two elements of that, that she recognized the handwriting and she recognized the names. When we say she testified about the practices and procedures, she had considerable testimony about the practice of paying these gifts. She had very skeletal and ambiguous testimony about the practice of making the list. And of course, that's the element of testimony that's required in order to authenticate this as a business record. But this is a natural introduction to our 404B argument, which is a slightly larger point, which not just the list, but the testimony about paying these gifts. So just to reiterate what we say in our briefs, this is not charged conduct, and there's no evidence that these gifts were bribes, so there was no action asked in exchange for these gifts. Instead, it was a practice of this contractor, Mr. Garniata, I'm guessing at the pronunciation of his name, it seems likely. Mr. Garniata paid gifts to a number of people, including union officials and people that worked at the building department. And, of course, this is not part of the charged conspiracy. So it's introduced under Rule 404B, and the parties and the judge were very clear. They repeatedly discussed this in terms of Rule 404B, and that's very clear in the record. So the question then, of course, becomes, is this introduced for an impermissible purpose, such as to show proclivity or the tendency to engage in these actions? Or instead, was it some other permissible purpose under Rule 404B? Our contention is that it serves nothing other than to show propensity. The logic here is Mr. Reese had accepted gifts from Ms. Romasanta or Mr. Garniata through Ms. Romasanta, and so is more likely to have accepted bribes. And, of course, that's precisely the inference we're not allowed to make. The court did speak in some terms of a trust relationship, that this tends to show a trust relationship. But I think if we dig in on that a little bit, it starts to bleed very quickly into simply being evidence to show propensity. What is the trust? The trust is you can accept a gift from me, therefore you can accept a bribe from me. Or it's the government, I believe, said in its briefing, it showed, excuse me just a moment, this is in the record in A28. The government said this would show the defendant had the intent to commit the charged bribery, and then we think the intent just collapses into the intent. It had the accepted bribes, and so is just more likely to have accepted bribes.
Did the government's evidence make clear that these gifts were illegal? If they were given as testified.
I can't recall any evidence or instruction to the jury that this would have been over a permissible limit.
Isn't that kind of important for drawing any conclusion with respect to a trust relationship? I mean, the move between legal gratuities, and I don't know whether it could be a cup of coffee or a lunch,
precisely,
to thousands of dollars in illegal bribes is a pretty big step.
I think that's an excellent point. So, and I would agree with Your Honor that it's a $200 gift card, which, because we've read the statutes, know it is impermissible. But that wasn't the impression given to the jury. So that it was an even larger leap.
Jury is bribes, wasn't it?
It was at some point, which is entirely the judge, I know, spoke of a bribe list, which is further evidence that the judge was failing to distinguish carefully between evidence of a gift, albeit an impermissibly large gift, and evidence of a bribe. So the judge was not appreciating that distinction carefully in making the appropriate 404B ruling. And I would like to just briefly talk about why we think these errors are not harmless on the issue of both the business record and the 404B point. And of course, we quote at length that the judge, as in, I believe in her own words, struggled with the issue and went back and forth. And she, when she was making these rulings, had read the entire Santiago proffer and was familiar with the prosecution's case and knew what the evidence was and had seen some of the witnesses, and was saying, and I won't bore you by reading too much, but it says something to the effect that this is unlike other cases. In fact, there was another case in this same investigation of a man named Darrell Williams who was caught on tape counting out money. The judge said, and I don't know exactly what the piece of evidence was there, but said, this is different than Mr. Williams' case, where there's a lot of other evidence. Then when you go upstairs, it's harmless. She said, this is different. This is the only physical record you have of, she was saying, an actual bribe. And as Your Honor points out, it was actually a gift, but it's an evidentiary record of receiving an improper payment. So the court below recognized that this was an important part of the prosecution's case. We can also see that by looking at the prosecution's closing. Said that this list speaks volumes. And we can also do it by just appraising what the other evidence was here. And as I started by saying, the other evidence here is testimony from co-conspirators in two cases testifying pursuant to a plea agreement. In a third case, somebody that had been convicted already of bribery and was under investigation for mortgage fraud. This is Mr. Oros. So certainly a jury would be well within reason to consider that testimony at least questionable. And so we think it's clear that the introduction of this hard evidentiary evidence of an improper payment made the prosecution's case stronger, or the absence of it would have made the prosecution's case considerably less persuasive, which is, of course, the standard that we look to on harmless error. Excuse me just a moment. Again, I would like to briefly talk about sentencing and also, if we have time, another of the evidentiary rulings that we feel was problematic. So in sentencing, as we explain in our brief, and the government also is helpful in carefully setting out what the loss amounts are. The total loss amount here is reduced from $117,000 to $112,500. That included a lot of money that was paid to Mr. Johnson, who was one of the co-conspirators testifying pursuant to a plea agreement. Mr. Johnson has considerable testimony that he had no intention of sharing this with Mr. Reese. There was no sort of kickback or flowback of cash here. This was Mr. Johnson's business. We feel that in a case like this, with something of a shaky record generally, and also where other much more central characters in this scheme were Mr. Johnson got 18 months, for example, for cooperating, that we think it's very problematic when a lot of conduct that was just on Mr. Johnson's behalf is used to elevate into a whole other bracket the sentence of Mr. Reese. If we subtract these amounts that are just Mr. Johnson's business, there's a $45,000, $12,000, Oros and Johnson, $4,000, Garniata and Johnson, another solicited but not paid bribe of $4,000 of Mr. Antoine to Mr. Johnson, $800, Oros to Johnson. We add all those amounts up. Mr. Reese, the loss amount would drop from $112,500 way down to $65,000, which would put him in another sentencing bracket and would potentially shave several months off the sentence. We feel that would be appropriate. Finally, on the other evidentiary ruling that we feel is problematic is a number of recordings with Ms. Roma Santa, who was an unindicted co-conspirator but was charged separately. After Ms. Roma Santa became a cooperating witness, she attempted to get Mr. Reese to say things on tape, which would be incriminating, and was unsuccessful in doing so repeatedly. We feel if we put this in the context of the prosecution's case, that those should have been included under Rule 106 for completeness. The prosecution introduced a very small number of recordings with Mr. Johnson and with this government informant, Danny, and then showed these phone logs that showed a lot of contact between Reese and Johnson, between Reese and Oros, between Reese and Roma Santa, and explicitly invited the jury to make the assumption that those were indicative of guilt and, indeed, that they were likely to be of the type that were actually played for the jury. So here are a couple of recordings. Now let's look at a list of that shows you how many phone calls there were. We can all guess what's happening here. And we submit that Mr. Reese should have been allowed to introduce other evidence of actual phone recordings between Reese and Roma Santa in order to put that argument in context and to help combat that argument.
Are those things that occurred after the existence of this investigation became known somehow?
They are.
How did the investigation become known?
It was gradual. I think by May of what Mr. Oros and Mr. Johnson were arrested in at the end of 2006. It's not clear from the record how public that was to other members of this department. Mr. Johnson was then able to be a cooperating witness and engaged in a lot of controlled bribes with other people in the department, so clearly the cat was not completely out of the bag at that point. There was no evidence that Mr. Johnson was able to engage in that similar activity with Mr. Reese, which I think is also somewhat helpful. But over the course of, I believe, through May of 2007, I believe there were newspaper reports by that time. Regardless, we would just say that that's not a reason not to introduce the evidence with Mr. Reese, between Mr. Reese and Ms. Roma Santa, but that would go to the weight of the evidence and the jury's free to do whatever it feels is appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Ms. Zell, for the government.
May it please the Court, my name is Kate Zell, and I represent the United States. The District Court did exactly what it was supposed to do in this case. It exercised its discretion after carefully considering the rules of evidence and the specific facts of each evidentiary issue. In doing so, the District Court properly admitted 404B evidence of Catherine Roma Santa's practice of giving holiday gift cards to city inspectors, including the defendant, in order to keep those inspectors happy. This gift card testimony was admitted under 404B not to show propensity of the defendant to commit further crimes, but in order to show the defendant's specific intent to solicit payments from Roma Santa, another member of the conspiracy. Additionally, the evidence was admitted in order to show the nature of the co-conspirator relationship between these two individuals.
Was the jury informed that these payments were illegal?
No, there was no direct question that were these payments illegal. The question was why.
Isn't that important?
Pardon?
Isn't that kind of important for your theory?
Well, if they were not illegal, then our theory is that there was minimal prejudice from a gift card that was.
You all used them. You said it speaks volumes, right, in the closing.
In one sentence in the closing, we said that the gift list speaks volumes. The gift list came up in one paragraph, seven lines of a 28-page transcript. Yes.
All right. So what volumes did it speak if the payments were not illegal?
The testimony of Roma Santa about the gift list, before the list was even admitted, the testimony that came in under 404B, was that the purpose of these gift cards was to keep inspectors happy, that her boss, Garniata, wanted to pay these out at the holiday season to grease the wheels, to keep them happy, to keep this warm flow of benefits going back between them. So her testimony that the gifts were for keeping them happy. Implicit in that is that the idea is that they're being paid for an improper purpose in order to keep them happy, but no specific question was asked, were these illegal gratuities? Other questions were asked about whether inspectors could accept fees for people seeking permits and whether there was any reason an inspector could accept money in the form of a fee, and the answer to that question was no. So the specific question about whether it was illegal was not asked in the record, but Roma Santa did say her boss did it in order to keep the people happy. So under 404B, we ask whether it's a similar act, and in this case, this is a similar act in the sense that an inspector is soliciting a payment of a type be it illegal or non-illegal, in exchange for something that the inspector shouldn't be doing, soliciting payment for someone in order to keep the inspector happy. That is similar to the bribery charge in conspiracy. This happened at the time of the conspiracy, and it was relevant to show both his intent to solicit payments from Roma Santa and to show the nature of this trust relationship between them. That this isn't at trial, the trust relationship, the nature of the relationship between the two co-conspirators was at issue. The defendant claimed, well, he didn't testify, but his theory was that he was not involved at all. And that his relationship with Roma Santa was not one of trust. But if he is calling up this woman, asking her questions like this, in addition to numerous other phone calls that were that happened between the two, this does speak to the nature of their relationship, which is the reason that it was entered under 404B. And that is a permissible reason, and it does not necessarily show propensity. As far as this happened during the time of the conspiracy as well. In 2005, Roma Santa specifically testified that she delivered the card to the defendant in 2005, and that in 2006 he called to ask where his card would be at that time. As far as whether this evidence prejudiced the defendant, we argue that in light of all of the other evidence or substantial evidence that the defendant participated in a long-standing conspiracy, that the defendant had personally accepted bribes from Roma Santa and others on 11 occasions. The jury heard all of that testimony, including specifics about where Roma Santa met him in front of the Starbucks at Comiskey Park, different details that were very specific. Also heard evidence from Roma Santa that the defendant called her and asked, anything, do you need anything right now? Asking, you know, can I help you in an illegal way? Things were slow for him at that time. In addition to Roma Santa's testimony, the most significant testimony in this case was the defendant's own words himself. And he was recorded in conversations with someone who was trying to get permits outside of the city process. What did the defendant do? Say, call me back on my cell phone. So this is all recordings that the jury heard. So the person calls him back on his cell phone. They proceed to have a few conversations in which the defendant kind of hedges. Well, you kind of have to go through the normal process. You can't get things much quicker. The caller, Danny, pushes him back a little and says, but is there anything you can do? And the defendant responds, well, I might be able to connect you with an inspector who will let you work for a small fee. And then he proceeds to give the caller the inspector's private personal cell phone number. This is not working through the city of Chicago in order to give permits in the proper course of business. Who does he refer him to? Johnson, who then accepts $800 from him in the course of that particular aspect of the conspiracy. This was the way the conspiracy worked. Johnson testified to numerous bribes over a course of years and years that these two referred to, bribe payers that they referred to each other, bribe takers that they either shook down or whatever, and the money that they shared over time. As outlined in the facts, this was longstanding, and the evidence was not solely limited to Roma Santa. There were three witnesses, the defendant's own testimony. In light of all that, any error in admitting evidence about a $200 gift card, which may not even be prejudicial, is surely not prejudicial or unfairly prejudicial.
Talk to me a little bit about this being a business record. I'm a little concerned that Roma Santa did not know if and how the lists were maintained, and it was found, am I correct, by a plumber?
It was found by another person who was working at the office.
And it was a blank pad?
It was a notepad, and it was written within that pad of paper. That's correct.
Several years before?
It was several years after the event.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Correct. So
so how's that different from miscellaneous jottings like in U.S. versus Kaiser where U.S. versus Ramsey where the individual took notes to keep track of telephone calls on an actual calendar?
Off the top of my head, I can't remember what the record custodian or the qualified witness, what foundation was laid in Ramsey, but the district court here looked at the rules, Rule 8036, and considered whether it was prepared in the normal course of business. The preparation of the list happened every Christmas. It's a small sample size. There are only going to be four or five Christmases where Roma Santa worked with this man and saw this, knew that the list was being generated. It was made at or near the time. At the holiday, Roma Santa testified that she personally handed out cards based on the list that he generated, made by Garniata, who generated his list while Roma Santa generated hers. She was personally involved in comparing her list with his, though she only saw one or two of the lists that he had prepared.
Did she testify that she had, in fact, distributed gifts as per this particular list?
Not per this particular list, no. She testified that in 2005, which matches with this list, she did give the defendant his card, but she did not say that she had this list in her hand and then went out and delivered with it.
Given the fact that this is on a telephone pad, this could be a working draft, couldn't it?
Potentially it could be a working draft. The redacted information that said done suggests that it actually was used in order to track the distribution of the gift cards, but that aspect the judge felt was too prejudicial and was redacted. So I think for this list in particular, that adds...
Well, can we consider it in terms of purposes of admissibility, even if the judge would not let the jury consider it for purposes of, because he thought it was too prejudicial on the ultimate issue?
The aspect of the done? I believe that would speak to a different aspect, because the judge is deciding whether it's admissible and can... in its discretion, decide that a certain aspect is too prejudicial. So the judge had the entire list in front of it in order to decide whether it was a credible document. I think as far as whether it was a regular practice to make the record, this is indeed the issue that the court struggled with. The woman had only seen one or two of the lists made, but she knew about the process from discussing it with Garniata. So it's reasonable jurists could disagree that this is the type of business record that falls under the rule, but in this case, the judge went through the elements of a rule, explained where she found in the witness's testimony to support each of the elements, and in her discretion decided to admit it. Of course, reasonable jurists could disagree about that, whether it's an appropriate list for the purposes of the rule. The judge, yes?
So tell me, when did he strike the done? Did he say this list was kept in the ordinary course of business? I'm going to let it in, but I'm going to strike the done?
No, the judge struck the done prior to the ultimate decision. Prior to the voir dire of the witness. So the judge struck the done. And then, in fact, after the voir dire of the witness, the district court said the prejudice from the list was minimized especially after hearing the voir dire of the witness and the fact that the defendant himself called the witness, Roma Santa, and asked her about the list, added an extra measure of credibility that the judge then felt bolstered the credibility and authenticity of the business record.
Did he say that he was striking the done because of possibility of prejudice?
Oh, yes. Yeah, prior to voir dire, the judge said that it felt the done was too prejudicial because it showed a completed bribe. So
that was my point. In other words, in considering the admissibility of the document, he apparently considered the done. He didn't want the jury to see it, but he looked at it.
Correct, yes. The judge had seen the done. Yes.
Which, and having the done on it, makes it more look like it was more in the regular course of business than somebody's musings.
I would agree with that, yes. The done does make it appear as though it was actually used in 2005 to track the distribution of those gift cards. The judge said that the relevance was not overborne by prejudice because of the very strong testimony on the part of the witness and others about the numerous bribes that the defendant had taken in the conspiracy. I'd like to just address now the defendant or the district court's decision at sentencing and how this was not clear error. The defendant was convicted of participation in a bribery scheme that spanned many years. The relevant conduct in that was the bribes accepted by Johnson years before the charged conspiracy. Relevant conduct is fair game at sentencing, and a defendant is responsible for any losses that are reasonably foreseeable in the course of the conspiracy. The district court made a record of the specific places in the testimony where it was pulling this information from, pulling the support from for each of the amounts charged to the defendant. The amount, there's approximately $26,700 in bribes that the defendant personally took, solicited, or paid, including one of the $10,000 bribe that he attempted to get out of Greg Jackson but did not complete. There were approximately $57,000 in bribes that Oros passed to Johnson in exchange for unit changes. The judge outlined what those were for. These were, Oros was the person that the defendant had personally connected with Johnson. So they had, he, for the express purpose of helping him get building permits and other city official acts outside of the course of business, knowing that those would accept, that those would involve bribes. There was $20,000 that the judge counted that Johnson had shared with the defendant over time. These were for various items, lifting code violations, lifting stop work orders that came out of Johnson's testimony, and numerous other pieces of evidence, all of which the judge, and the $800 bribe that the confidential informant paid to Johnson after the defendant referred the confidential informant to him. Based on the record made at sentencing and the testimony at trial that underlied each of these, it was not clear error for the district court to attribute the $112,700 to the defendant as reasonably foreseeable losses involved in the conspiracy. If there are no further questions at this time, I'll end by asking the court to affirm the conviction and the sentence.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Zell. Mr. Dunn, rebuttal. How much time? None. Take two.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry for running over before. A couple of quick points in 2 minutes here. On the point of harmlessness, the government reprises the transcript recordings and the phone recordings and emphasizes their nature. I'm sure the court has done so, but I would encourage you again to read the transcript, which is in the government's appendix. I think you'll find that the recordings are extremely ambiguous at trial. They had to have others testify on what they thought that that meant, and in fact the court referred to this as some sort of code, as we cite in our brief. And so we would, and I think it's also important to remember that this, there were, the government was investigating Reese for a long time and repeatedly tried to find more incriminating recordings with Mr. Johnson and Ms. Romasanta, and this is what they got. So it just, I think, underlines it's something of a shaky case. Just, and the final point on this, the fact that this Dunn was redacted and what effect, if any, that has on both prejudice and it, the fact that it's a business record. I think it does very little to mitigate prejudice because I think any jury looking at that with the word done redacted would still think this is a record of gifts that were paid. So I think redacting the done, while it shows the court was properly attuned to the potential prejudice, was insufficient to remedy that prejudice. And finally, I would just say that there's no we might speculate about whether or not this done shows that this is a recording of actual recorded facts or and amplifies that this might be a business record, but I'll emphasize that there was no testimony about Mr. Garniata writing Dunn or using this in order to track that gifts had been paid, for example. And, of course, that testimony is what's needed to lay the foundation. I think that's my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dunn. Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Dunn, also thanks to the court, to you and your law firm for taking the appointment in this case, the service you provided to the court and to the client. Our next case for argument this morning is St. Paul Fire versus Chile Transportation, number 11-2307. And we'll hear from Mr. Withered. Mm-hmm.